Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to mystery writer Max Allen Collins, the creator of the graphic novel Road to Perdition, which inspired the film of the same name. He's also Mickey Spillane's hand-chosen successor to continue the Mike Hammer detective franchise. His latest is Lady Go Die, a sequel to the classic I, the Jury. Stick around. Watch us get a jump on these dumb hicks. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. stitcher.com/mrmedia. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of flat-footed coppers and irresistible dames with those long chorus girl gams I dream of in Technicolor, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I'm going to welcome mystery author Max Allen Collins to the show in a minute, but first I want to tell you about a guy who had a big influence on me when I was a wannabe writer. His name was Michael Avallone. He was best known for writing TV and film adaptations of movies such as Beneath the Planet of the Apes and TV shows such as The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and even The Partridge Family. But he would have preferred to be remembered for his Ed Noon detective tales. Well, thankfully, the New York Times, in its 1999 obituary, described Mike as a prolific writer of detective stories and other novels that were sometimes reminiscent of old-fashioned pulp fiction. Now, I got to know Mike after reading in the newspaper that he lived in the next town over from where I grew up in central New Jersey. So I did what any kid with no sense of propriety would do. I looked him up in the phone book. Now, when Mike got on the phone, 16-year-old me told him I wanted to be a writer too. And he was very kind and said he'd be happy to meet me. Now, I don't remember exactly the timing, but it seems like I rode my 10-speed English racer to his house the very next day. We talked for a good hour or two, and I marveled at his typewriter and all the books that he had written, because they were spread out all over the library. Now, I think it's safe to say he was most proud of his Ed Noon detective mysteries, which he wrote for more than 30 years. And I have to say at this point, Avallone and Noon, he'd like to think that he was from the Mickey Spillane, Mike Hammer genre. Mickey Spillane, I don't know if he even knew that Mike existed. It's hard to say. Maybe my guest will know. But that was his intent. Now, of course, Mike was not as hard-boiled and maybe not as talented, but he was more than entertaining enough for me. He autographed a few of his Noon paperbacks for me as souvenirs and sent me on my way. And we spoke a few more times over the years as I went on to college and actually started writing for a living, and he was a guest of honor at a comic book convention that I put on in the 1970s. Now, I tell you all this because preparing to interview Max Allen Collins, I got to thinking a lot of Mike Avallone. Now, Collins became a next-generation Mickey Spillane, creating memorable titles and characters of his own, such as Road to Perdition and Mike Quarry. He's worked in all kinds of media, from scripting Dick Tracy daily comic strips from 1977 to 1993, to writing the novelizations of movies, such as Saving Private Ryan and American Gangster, and even creating his own one-man show, Elliot Ness, An Untouchable Life. The crowning achievement of his career, however, may have been when Mickey Spillane, the best-selling mystery writer of the 20th century, chose Collins to be his literary executor. Now, Spillane passed away in 2006, and Collins has since lit a fire in new stories of Private Dick Mike Hammer. The latest is Lady Go Die, the riveting sequel to Spillane's classic I, the Jury. So what's the connection, in my mind at least, between Max Allen Collins and my late friend Michael Avallone? Not much, really. Same business, different levels of success, and different levels of execution. And frankly, I wondered if Max even knew Mike's work. I think I'll ask. Max Allen Collins, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, it's great to be here. I did read Mike Avallone. Is it Avallone or Avallone? I hear it differently.
I've heard it both ways, yeah.
I knew him a little bit. We had contact. He was an interesting, eccentric guy. He was one of I read all the Private Eye writers when I was growing up in the late 50s and early 60s. And, you know, books like The Tall Dolores,
right,
for example, and The Spitting Image. So I knew his work. I know his work. And I also know that he worked in the tie-in area, the movie novels and the TV tie-ins, as I have. And he's very well known and very well thought of among the tie-in writers. He suffered a certain amount of sort of lampooning because he was he wrote so quickly that there were oftentimes just howlers in his work in terms of unintentional humor. But there was also a lot of intentional humor, and there was a lot of energy in the writing. There actually is a connection you probably don't know, which is that when I first started publishing, I was at a company called Curtis Books, which had some kind of relationship to Saturday Evening Post. This is in 1972. My first two novels were published by Curtis Books, and they were in the process of publishing Mike Avalone's final couple of Ed Noon novels. So I entered when kind of as he was exiting. So, he was kind of notorious for writing incredibly angry letters to you. And then if you actually ran into them, he was gracious and even obsequious, frankly. He admired and envied Mickey Spillane and wrote, and he and Mickey did know each other, and he would send Mickey stuff, and Mickey was very gracious to Mike, who obviously, I think Mickey was fairly aware that Mike was not in his class, yeah. Let's say.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned that, and it does remind me of, you know, sort of my childish enthusiasm for this stuff and how, you know, these writers who many of whom are very obscure now, people even who are fans of this stuff don't even remember some of these people. But for me, these were superstars. These were my heroes, you know, writers like Mike Roscoe. Ever hear of Mike Roscoe, you know, and he wrote Riddle Me This, and he wrote, how about this for a noir title? One Tear for My Grave.
Ooh,
I mean, there's some great writers. And then Enos Willie, who had written a series of very, very interesting, pulpy, Spillane-ish crime novels in the early 60s for a softcore porn house in Chicago. There's no porn in them, but that was who published the books, and they just packaged them that way. And there's a small group of us in mystery fiction who loved this guy's work and wondered who he was, because he wrote for about 4 years and disappeared. And we thought he might be a black guy. We thought his name might be a pseudonym. There were all kinds of theories. People like Ed Gorman and Stephen Mertz and Bill Kreider and some fairly major people in the field were big fans of his, and it was a mystery. And then thanks to the internet, a few years ago, he popped up, a very successful printer in the South, a Southern gentleman, and now he's been allowing his books to be reprinted, and they're being rediscovered by a whole new group of fans. It would be overstating to say generation of fans, because these are books, small press books, but you know, these guys were stars to those of us who were, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, and getting the bug to write hard-boiled fiction, as we called it. It's noir was a word not known to us.
It's this whole kind of, I mean, everyone knew Spillane. Everyone knows Spillane. But
right.
There was this whole, as I recall, in the 60s and 70s, there was this whole underclass of these guys who were doing that kind of writing, who, if you were interested in it, you knew where to find it. It wasn't something you were
right.
going to find, you know, in you know, the whatever the bookstore of the day was.
To find the stuff by Enos Willie, I had to go to big city, really big, the kind of bookstore that was just filled with paperbacks and all kinds of magazines, the kind of newsstand bookstore. I'd be on vacation with my parents, and I didn't get them in Muscatine, Iowa. That where I live, lived then and live now. That's for sure. But Spillane was so popular and so important that gold medal books existed because of Spillane, because he had sort of uncovered this huge market of readers, initially primarily male. And gold medal became the first major paperback original publisher. They paid Spillane to write blurbs for them. He was an editorial consultant. And out of that comes John D. MacDonald, the Shel Scott books by Richard S. Prather, Stephen Marlowe's Chet Drum books, and just many, many wonderful. I mean, gold medal now is by many of the buffs of this kind of stuff, the gold medal of, mystery fiction, hard-boiled fiction of that era. But Mickey was not prolific, which is partly why I'm involved in bringing out these books right now. And so because he was enormously successful, these books were selling millions and millions and millions of copies when that really had never happened before. And so a lot of publishers, his own publisher, for example, Signet, were finding guys, because Avalon published for Signet for a while. They were bringing anybody in who could do anything that was even vaguely like Mickey Spillane. Mm. So there's a lot of books that you find in old bookstores and at paperback shows. The covers are almost interchangeable with Mickey's covers. But only Mickey had his special blend of, sex, violence, surrealism, incredible first person, tumbling out of the side of your mouth narrative. There's a lot of elements that Mickey put together that nobody else ever has been able to master.
And as we were discussing before we went on the air, humor. There's that touch of humor in the books that is.
Well, there's dark humor. There's certainly dark humor. I mean, Mickey had a very good sense of Mike Hammer's absurdity. I mean, people who thought he didn't know what he was doing were, idiot snobs. He was. But one of the things I have to watch when I'm working on a Spillane project is that my sense of humor is not his sense of humor. Mm. His sense of humor is more a Howard Hawksian kind of male bonding guy humor. I'm sarcastic, and I do, my main guy is Nate Heller in my Nate Heller historical detective novels, and Nate is a smartass. So Nate is more out of the Philip Marlowe smartass school, wisecracks, that kind of thing. Nate Cameron's not much of a wisecrack kind of guy. He's unless it's a crack across a wise guy, that would be as close as he would come. But as you say, not that there's, not humor in there. But Mickey was, when I think of Mickey, I think of him smiling and kind of grinning to himself, because he was like a, my wife Barb always says he was a scamp, a rascal. I mean, he liked to shock. Mm. He got a kick out of dunking the pigtail in the inkwell. That's who he was. Also, sweet guy, very sweet, sweet, thoughtful, generous man.
Well, how did you and he, and I want to point something out for people who are watching this and thinking that I'm skipping to the current part of your career and missing all these other years in between. But we're here to talk about that, and I'm hoping we'll now that I didn't insult you with the Mike Avalon reference, we'll get you back to talk about, Heller and Quarry and things like that. But how did you and Spillane first connect, and how long ago was that?
Well, it really does go back to those years that we were just talking about. The writers that I discovered when I was about 13 were Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Mickey Spillane. It was pretty much intertwined. And I loved them all. I loved them probably equally. I think Spillane was my favorite. Spillane remains my favorite, even though I think the other two probably, in some respects, are superior writers, but they're all three such different writers, it's hard to quantify. I mean, Spillane could do things that Hammett and Chandler couldn't, and vice versa. And Chandler and Hammett were very different writers, for as much as they, they are linked. And I've always been somebody that goes the extra step. Like when I was growing up, if there was a TV show based on a book, I had to go find the book and read it. If it was a movie based on history, I had to go out and read the history. That's always been, you know, and probably the Untouchables TV show has a lot to do with who I am, because I had to go out and read the stuff about the real gangsters and research the real Elliot Ness. So, you know, that was a big, big, big part of it. And so one of the things I did was I went to look to see what the critics thought about. Now, remember, I'm 13, 14 years old, but I'm going to the library. I'm going, you know, I'm going back and reading what people said about Hammett and what people said about Chandler and Spillane. Well, basically, they loved Hammett, they loved Chandler, and they hated Spillane. And I uncovered this incredible McCarthy-era witch hunt, hysterical reaction to Mickey's work. A lot of people don't know that Frederick Wortham's famous book, Seduction of the Innocent, which is all about how terrible comic books are, also takes on one writer of prose, and that's Mickey Spillane. So when you read, who was a comic book writer at one point, So when you read Seduction of the Innocent, all of a sudden there's Mickey Spillane getting beat up. And so I became very defensive about Mickey, and I became very much his kind of protector, which is crazy since he was the most popular writer of the 20th century, but I became his defender. And as I began writing about him in my school papers, I wrote about him at the University of Iowa when we, in the writer's workshop, where we were supposed to write a thesis paper about a major American writer. All the other writer's workshop people were doing, you know, Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Carson McCullers. I was doing Mickey Spillane. And I'll tell you what, the instructors there loved it, because they were bored to death with reading more students writing about Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. And so then as my career kicked in, I began writing articles about Mickey. I would defend him if there was a bad review or somebody saying something about him that was just, you know, offhandedly dismissive. And so about the same, as I was starting to come up through in the 1970s as a writer myself, I also on some level was the Mickey Spillane guy. You know, Collins is this guy that loves Mickey Spillane's books. Now, the fact is, I also loved Hammett, also loved Chandler, also loved Kane.
I was going to ask you about
Chester Himes, also loved, you know, but they didn't need my help.
Yeah.
And also, Mickey was the guy I read and got into my bloodstream when I was an adolescent. He's the one that made my head explode. So that was a big part of it. So in the early 80s, there was a BoucherCon, the big mystery convention, as you know, in Milwaukee. And because Mickey at that time had started the Miller Lite beer commercials, where he famously spoofed himself.
Those are great.
The people, very cannily at the convention, went to Miller Beer and arranged for Mickey to be a special guest. And somebody there, I have no idea who, I don't remember, called me and said, we have Mickey coming into the BoucherCon. You're a guest. Would you please be the liaison between the convention and Mickey? Now, understand, I had written Mickey easily 100 fan letters over the years. I had only received one response from him, and that was when I sent him copies of my first two published novels in 1973, and he wrote me back a lovely letter congratulating me and welcoming me to the professional community of writers. But all these other letters, you know, they were stones dropped down a well, and I didn't even hear the splash. So we go to his hotel, the people from the convention and I, to introduce me to Mickey. Mickey comes to the door, and the person from the convention says, Mickey, this is Max Collins. And Mickey says, oh, I know Max. We've been corresponding for years. And I said, that's right, Mickey. 100 letters from me and one letter from you. And we were fast friends. I should also say we did a very, I think, memorable two-man panel at the convention. Mickey had never done a mystery convention. He felt that he was that sort of the common man was his audience, and that the mystery fans, he mistakenly thought that a lot of them looked down upon him. Extrapolating that from all of the professional mystery writers who had been insulting to him, The MWA at one point turned him down as a member. Think about that. A guy who was feeding the industry, making it possible for other people to have, you know, careers. They were just that disrespectful to him. And so the room was packed. I mean, it looked like, it looked like a panel at San Diego Comic-Con where, you know, they were announcing the new Star Trek movie or something. It was huge. Everybody at the convention was there, and it was just Mickey and me, and it was a really good panel where I got to ask him all the questions that the fans had always wanted to ask him and never been able to. And then I started visiting him once or twice a year in his home in South Carolina, and we began doing projects together. I did sometimes with other editors, co-editors, anthologies of his short stories, short fiction, sometimes nonfiction. Then he and I did anthologies of other crime writers. We did a bunch of things together. I did a documentary about him. He appeared in a couple of my independent films. We did the Mike Danger comic book together. So we did a lot of projects together. Never wrote a novel together, but we did a lot of projects together. He is my son Nathan's godfather. So wow. We did become tight. We did become friends, and he was a wonderful man. He was my literary father, and I think I was his literary son. I really do.
What was it like actually working on projects with him? What did you learn about the way he worked or the way he thought, or just, you know, how did that go?
I think Mickey, like a lot of writers, was really good at not writing, you know, finding reasons not to write. There was a lot of, there was more warming up when I went down to visit him, which was all right because, I mean, I'm hearing stories and we're having a great time.
Yeah.
To be perfectly frank, most of the projects I did with him, I did the heavy lifting.
I was guessing it. That was the case. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was very much involved. We Mike Danger, the revision of Mike Danger, the science fiction version of a Mike Hammer type character, that came out of a brainstorming session that we did in one of his offices. And it was a lot of fun. But it'd be something like I could say to him, I can't think of a decent name for this character. And he'd say, I'll get back to you. And then 2 days later, he'd hand me a piece of paper, and there'd be like 9 names on it. And he'd say, one of these should work. So it was kind of fun. I mean, it was different. I do think he would not have been easy to collaborate with on a novel because I think that was his thing, and he liked the solitariness of the writing process, the idea that he was channeling and just funneling his creativity, his own creativity onto that page.
I would think it'd be brutal. I think I saw in the last couple of weeks that Stephen King had written a book with his son, and I thought, poor kid. I just can't imagine.
It depends. I mean, you know, I do a lot of collaboration. I don't just collaborate with Mickey, who's very easy to collaborate with now that he's gone.
I was wondering if you were going to go there. I wasn't going to say it.
But my wife Barb and I write together. Uh-huh. There's one of my best friends is a guy named Matt Clemens, and he wrote all the CSI novels with me, and we have done 2 thrillers together, and we're working on another thriller right now. And, you know, I love working with Matt, love working with Barb. Working process there is actually similar, although I don't sleep with Matt.
I have
no interest either. And I think he would second that. What we do is we plot the books together, and then the other writer, which is to say Barb, in the case of our Antiques books, the new one's called Antiques Disposal. And as with Matt too, they write the first draft, and I stay out of their way. If they have a question for me, if they have a concern and want to discuss something, plot point, if they're going to get off what the plot we devised, if they're going to go in another direction. They'll check with me and we'll discuss it. But basically, I think this is a can be very helpful in collaboration. I stay out of their way. Then when they deliver their draft to me, they deliver a short draft. I mean, if it's a book, let's say I was supposed to turn in a 400-page manuscript, they might give me 250, 300 pages at most, give me some room to breathe, to expand, to, and, you know, write dialogue in particular. They kind of know I'm going to do the dialogue and probably do all their dialogue over, so they kind of underwrite the dialogue. And that's how the process works. And a good collaboration is not really about time saving. It's about coming up with a third voice to have it be 2 + 2 = 12. Have it to have it be a third writer that neither one of you could have been alone.
Well, so tell us a little about your relationship to the. Before we get to your relationship with the estate, at what point did Mickey say, "Hey, I want to get you involved with what's going on with me"? Was it him or was it the estate?
No, it was him. Okay. It was. There were hints all the way along. As early as the early 80s, he sent two of the unfinished Mike Hammer novels home with me. You know, 200-100-page manuscripts. And he's saying, we might do something with this someday. But was that vague. But toward the very end of his life, he was dying of pancreatic cancer. He knew he did not have long for this world. And a week or so before he passed, he called me and said, I think I'm going to get the Goliath Bone finished. That was his last Mike Hammer, the Goliath Bone. He wanted that to be the last chronologically. He said, I'm tired, I'm trying. And I said, well, and I basically said, don't worry about it, Mickey. I'll take care of it. And he said, good. And it was kind of that elliptical. He was passing it. If I don't get this done, you need to finish it for me. And then his wife, Jane, who I've known for many, many years, we're very good friends and close. He said to his wife, Jane, just days before he passed, said, after I'm gone, there's going to be a treasure hunt around here. Take everything you find and give it to Max. He will know what to do. So my wife Barb and I went down there after there was kind of a wake for him, a beautiful celebration of his life. And we stayed down there for about a week going through all the material in his three offices. And for various reasons, I won't go into them because you could do a book on this, but for various reasons, there were a lot of unfinished manuscripts. And we had six major, substantial, unfinished Mike Hammer novels. Now, the significance of that can only be understood if you realize that he only wrote 13 Mike Hammer novels.
Wow.
Now, you know, there are
50% more.
How many? There are almost 100 Perry Mason novels by Earl Stanley Gardner. There are 70-some Nero Wolfs by Rex Stout. There are, 70 or 80 Perots by Agatha Christie. Everybody probably thinks casually there must have been 20, 30, 40 Mike Hammer novels. There were 13. For the hardcore Mike Hammer fan, you know, you'd wait sometimes 20 years between books with Mickey. And it was excruciating. Here, when's the next Mike Hammer going to come out? So there were to find half a dozen books that were really substantial, sometimes with endings, sometimes with notes, character notes, sometimes not. I thought these books have to be finished. And in a case of several of them, I knew that didn't have endings. I knew what the endings were because Mickey had told me. Because we would set up late at night in one of his offices and he would talk shop because he had nobody in South Carolina he could talk shop with. Toward the last 20 years of his life, I probably was his only writer friend. And he would just start spinning these Mike Hammer stories as if I was sitting around a campfire. And he loved his endings, and his endings were wild. And he'd tell me these endings. And, of course, I didn't forget those endings. And so when I'm going through the manuscripts, I'd say, oh, I know which one this is. This is the one that had that ending, or this is the one that had that ending. And so the process has been, I don't know, a little scattered, I will admit. But there were six Mike Hammers. There are another three shorter manuscripts of about 40 pages that I hope someday to also finish. But the six were my priority. Then there's some fragments where he maybe did 3 to 10 pages that I'm gradually turning into short stories. There will be enough of those to make a collection. I've published, I think, 3 or 4 of those so far. And there should be about 8 when I'm done, 8 or 8 to 10. And there are a few non-Mike Hammer things, too. There's a book called Dead Street. That was the first thing that I completed. And that was almost done. I only wrote the last couple of chapters and gave it a line edit, basically. And then there is a book called The Consummata, which is the sequel to a book he did called The Delta Factor. Those were both published by Hard Case Crime.
I was going to say, I read The Consummata. That's one crazy-ass story.
It's a crazy-ass story.
It's a crazy-ass story, yeah.
Yeah. And I enjoy that aspect of it. I mean, I enjoy the fact that that these books on some level need to be wild and that the endings need to be out there. The endings just absolutely need to be out there. Because Mickey said famously, you don't read a book to get to the middle.
Yeah.
And you asked, like, what kind of writing advice, I think. And I said that's great writing advice right there to an author. You know, nobody reads a book to get to the middle. He also said the first line sells this book. The browser, of course, is looking at. First line sells this book. Last line sells the next book.
That's a great line. I like that. Yeah.
All good advice.
And you know what? I've thought about the first line part a lot. Hadn't thought about the last line, but now you mention it, yeah, I'm gonna incorporate that going forward.
Well, you know, a few of the reviews of Lady Go Die, just a couple, were, I think, I don't think we've had a bad review, which is great, but I think they were kind of taken aback by the abruptness of the ending. But that was Mickey's style. That was his trademark. There was no scene in Perry Mason's office where Della and Paul Drake talk to him about all the loose ends. And they talk about going out for cocktails with Hamilton Berger. No, when you're the bad guy, here's how I figured it out. Now I'm going to set you on fire. The end. I mean, that's Mickey Spillane.
Right.
I mean, that, and I tell you what, when you look at these books now, and when some people say the sex is tame, it's still fairly potent. But the violence is still absolutely visceral and shocking. He wrote scenes in the late 40s and early 50s that still make Sam Peckinpah look like Little Bo Peep. And I try to capture that too. I mean, that's one of the ways he has influenced me in my writing, because people will sometimes say, well, how much Spillane influence is there in your own work? Action scenes and the depiction of violence very much comes out of Mickey, because I want it to be shocking, unpleasant. I also want it to be stream of consciousness. Every single book I write, I have to fight the copy editor who takes apart my run-on action and sex scenes, you know, because I'm trying to keep the reader pulled down in. And they go through, let's put a period here, let's put a period here, let's put a period here, let's put a period here. Well, that's why I'm writing the books, and they're just English majors who have a bad-paying job.
I was gonna try to stop you before you did any bridge burning there, because I know exactly what you're talking about. It drives me. You don't know this. I mean, I make my living writing books, but they're on the nonfiction side, and it drives me crazy when you get some copy editor who feels that they still have to exert themselves to rewrite things that don't need to be rewritten just to show you that that they're smarter than you. No.
Recently, I did something that I've wanted to do for my entire career, and I finally had the balls to do it. A copy editor had gone through and basically rewritten it and done all of this stuff, and the editor came back apologizing and telling me, I could put it all back the way it was. That was no problem. And I said, I tell you what, why don't you put it back the way it was? I don't approve any of these changes. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of walked away.
That's awesome.
And they said yes, because why is it my responsibility, and it has always been and probably always will be, to put Humpty Dumpty back together again? I didn't push him off the wall. Mm-hmm. I rested him up there on his little egg ass, just perfectly comfortably in balance.
His little egg ass. I like that. Yeah. Okay, you're my new hero for that story alone. I love that. I'm going to think of you every time I get galleys back from now until eternity.
Writers really need to as much as we need a union, we probably need a one day where we get together and drink all day and discuss copy editing.
Sounds good. I think the point where I realized I had grown up a bit was when I stopped fighting the little changes and just held my breath, held my nose through those, and then just went to the things that were really important. And then put the hammer down on the things that I felt were absolutely important, and I let the other stuff go. But yeah, there was a time when every little thing, I'd just be like, "Come on, this is ridiculous." Anyway,
I know.
Well, so
don't get me started.
No, I know. I think it's too late for that now. So, in terms of, you know, you already had a solid career going of your own. You had your own characters, your own books, as you say. You were doing novelizations as well. Working on Mickey's books, is it as lucrative, or do you take a step back from that to be able to work on Mickey Spillane, Mike Hammer books?
No, I mean, these are pretty high profile, but they're they're not necessarily the main thrust of my career. They're just one of the things I'm doing. Probably, believe it or not, the books I'm doing with my wife in this series about antiquing, these books that are called, you know, Antiques Roadkill was the first one. They're very funny. They're sort of traditional cozy mysteries, but they're sort of subversive. I mean, they really have some. This is not Murder, She Wrote. I mean, there's a lot of fun, crazy stuff in these books. Those are probably the most successful thing I'm doing right now. Nate Heller has made a really strong comeback. In addition to the first one I had done in 10 years, Bye Bye Baby, which is just came out in paperback a couple weeks ago. That's about Marilyn Monroe's murder. That was a very strong comeback for Nate Heller, and at the same time, Amazon brought out all of the backlist Nate Hellers, all at the same time, all in conjunction with the publication of the new Nate Heller. And on ebook in particular, he's had a great new lease on life. True Detective, the first book, went to number one on the paid Kindle list for a number of days.
Wow.
So I would say the thing that I'm not doing anymore, at least not much. I haven't done a novelization since, I think, about 2008. And I haven't been approached, nor have I really sought anything in the sort of the CSI Criminal Minds. You know, I did 10 CSIs and 3 Criminal Minds novels. And I would say Mike Hammer, which on some level is a licensed character, is the only thing I'm doing in that area right now. And of course, it's incredibly gratifying compared to, you know, just, I mean, writing a Criminal Minds book, which is, I think we did some really good ones. Matt Clemens worked on those with me. But doing Mike Hammer is, again, very gratifying. But I am in Mickey's shadow. And, you know, I'm never going to be the Mike Hammer guy. Mickey Spillane is the Mike Hammer guy. My job here is to complete these books in a way that Mickey would be satisfied and maybe even pleased with, and to bring that list of 13 up, because it was not enough books. I can't really imagine doing any new Mike Hammers that were 100% out of whole cloth. The point here is to get more Spillane content Mike Hammer out there. So right now, I really only envision 10 books, including the anthology of the short stories. I'd be very pleased to add 10 books to those 13.
Well, that's a lot. I mean, I was going to say, I was expecting you to say that when those are done, that you will. But of course, maybe, you know, maybe a couple of years down the line, maybe you'll change your mind.
Well, here's the thing. Mickey, again, he puttered a lot. So there are a lot of first chapters in this. I have a file cabinet drawer of unpublished material by him. And so if when I'm done with the Mike Hammers, there are a number of non-Hammer projects that I want to do. There are three screenplays, unproduced screenplays, that I'd like to turn into novels. One of them, get this, is a Western he wrote for John Wayne, because he and John Wayne were pals.
Wow.
And Wayne had, you know, had optioned it. It was never made. So that needs to be written someday. And then there are a lot of, as I say, one or two chapter fragments that are not Hammer, but all of Mickey Spillane's main characters are Mike Hammer. So if necessary, if the public wanted them, let's say there's a big Mike Hammer movie, which there may be because there's some stuff going on right now, I would always be able to take something from this drawer and have the germ of it, and to have some of the writing be Mickey's. There's actually no excuse for me doing something out of whole cloth.
No, I can see that. And you've got plenty of projects going on.
Yeah. And they're collaborations. I think one of the things that happened to me when I started doing independent film in the 90s was, and I also remember I come out of comics, so collaboration is something that is, you know, a lot of writers are just, as I mentioned with Mickey, very solitary, and it's a way you can be very controlling, and I can be very controlling too. But I'm also quite aware of the joys of and the benefits of a really positive collaboration. I mean, I've collaborated with Terry Beatty since like 1979, and we're still together as a team. We don't work together constantly. But we've, you know, our collaboration is a very positive one.
Okay. Well, I've kept you a lot longer than I planned to. So let me say this. I'd love to have you come back and talk about some other projects.
Sure.
We spent most of our time talking about Spillane. Maybe you and Barb would like to come on and talk about the Antiques books. I have a feeling that would be a lively conversation.
You bet.
So, folks, listen. You can find Lady Go Die, the latest Mike Hammer mystery by Mickey Spillane and my guest, Max Allen Collins. It's a sequel to I, the Jury, and it's in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Your website, I think where your blog is that's MaxAllenCollins.com?
It is. My son Nathan runs it, and I think he does a really great job on it. There's an update every Tuesday.
All right. And I didn't notice that you were on Twitter or Facebook, or am I incorrect?
I am on Facebook, and I'm a little lax about posting there. I'm trying to be better, and I have a Twitter account, and I don't use it very much, and I'm trying to be better about that as well. You can also find my band, Cruisin', on Facebook, because as you may know, I have been playing rock and roll since 1965 without much pause. And I'm still attempting to get it right with my band Cruisin'.
You got the glasses for it.
Yeah. Buddy Holly left them to me.
That's what I thought.
And I loaned them to Elvis Costello for a few years.
You got them back.
Got them back.
Very nice. Hey, Max Allen Collins, what a delight. What a pleasure to have you here. I enjoyed it. And I'd like to have you come back and talk about some other projects another time.
It'd be my pleasure.
Thank you so much, Max.
Thank you.
See and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Sit Your Favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest two-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Marc Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.
Hello, this is novelist Michael Connelly, and you're listening to Mr. Media.